The following is a CNA podcast.
Welcome back to the Climate Conversations. I'm Jamie Ho. Today, I'm talking about shipping and the emissions that are associated with the entire industry. As it stands, it falls into the same category as hard-to-abate industries such as aviation and oil and gas. But does shipping get less attention? Has it sailed under the radar? The global shipping trade is a vast network of unimaginable scale. 90% of the world's trade is done by sea. Every day, millions of vessels carry everything humans need. Clothes, shoes, food, from animal feed to fuel such as natural gas, from finished products to raw materials. In a sense, ships are the world's best workhorse. A single ship can carry 20,000 containers and runs on very cheap fuel. Unfortunately, that's also the problem. Experts say it is one of the trickiest industries to decarbonize. Add to this, the complex interconnected nature of international shipping means one country's efforts to green its shipping industry may not amount to much if others don't move in tandem. But can it rise above these difficulties? What are the solutions and how much would these cost? Is a more ambitious emissions goal simply a bar too high? With me to talk through this is Dr. Sanjay Kutan, Chief Technology Officer of the Global Center for Maritime Decarbonization, which has just been set up by the Maritime and Port Authority of Singapore. Prior to that, Sanjay was Executive Director of the Singapore Maritime Institute, which is responsible for funding projects and building research and development capabilities in the sector. Sanjay, welcome.
Hi, Jamie. Nice to be back.
Good to hear from you again. Let's start by getting a sense of the shipping industry and the industry's emissions. According to the IMO, the International Maritime Organization, shipping accounts for about 3% of global greenhouse gas emissions now, but that figure could rise, they say, by 10% by 2050. And shipping emissions are also projected to reach 90 to 130% of 2008 levels by 2050. So it's not even about reducing emissions now. Why are emissions from shipping on the rise when every other industry is looking to slash their emissions?
A couple of thoughts around that. First thing is shipping wants to reduce its emissions and is making every effort to find solutions to do so. Until we are able to find that alternative fuel, shipping activity carries on because of the demands from the global stage for goods and services. And shipping accounts for 80 to 90% of all goods that are moved around the world. So it is really pandering to consumers who want to buy stuff and goods need to be moved. So that growth doesn't abate with increase in population growth and aspirations.
I'll get to fuels and alternative fuels later on in our conversation, but I wonder whether sometimes the reason people don't have a sense of just how important the shipping industry is that somehow or other, it seems to have fallen slightly below the radar. People talk about aviation. Aviation seems to be on the radar quite often, whether it's at ICAO, whether it's the EU, for example, or oil and gas. People look at it quite strongly and with a very strong lens. But things like the Paris Agreement has excluded international shipping from targets. Do you think people don't get a sense of how much it actually contributes and therefore that regular consumer behavior does contribute to the fact that shipping emissions will grow? And now everything just seems to rest on the golden sort of outcome in trying to find an alternative fuel.
You're right there, because first thing is aviation is really very close to the consumer, right? We all travel for holidays or for work. It's very intimate. Unlike shipping, shipping is actually once removed.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone, unless you live in high rise, you're not even aware that the Port of Singapore has 1,000 ships in anchorage a day. And the goods are moved primarily through shipping. And that's not apparent to the consumer because they see the goods in the shop retail center rather than seeing it come off the boat. You know what I mean?
Now that you mentioned sitting in a high rise and looking out Singapore and looking at our waters around us, yes, indeed, they'll see ships. They'll see if you're on the East Coast. I believe all the ships there are bunkering, right? So let's talk about the actual thing here we're talking about in terms of bunker fuels. So let's go back to basics. Explain what is it about bunker fuels that makes it so, in a lack of a better word, dirty? And obviously, there's cost considerations there. And it feeds into the entire global logistics business and therefore factors into the cost of the goods that, as you say, we all consume. But talk about bunker fuels. What is it about them?
Bunker fuel is essentially your petrol and gasoline, but of a very low quality. So they're not highly refined hydrocarbons. And because there's always been a cost pressure to reduce the cost of goods accountable to transportation, you try to use the cheapest fuel so that you could get the cheapest mode of transportation. Strangely enough, people may not realize that shipping is the most energy efficient way of moving goods across kilometers.
Yeah.
And it does that not from an energy efficiency perspective, but also from a cost efficiency. So the bunker fuel is, in that sense, very similar to gasoline, but just lower quality, and it's just dirtier and heavier and has a lot more hydrocarbon mixture into it because it's not fully refined. We are stuck with that for the moment because hydrocarbon has a very high energy density. And this is a very important fact to realize when we start thinking about alternative fuels, because the vessel has space limitation, which means it wants to maximize carrying goods and it wants to minimize the amount of fuel it needs between ports of call. So hydrocarbon has a very high, in fact, I think the highest volumetric energy density. It's not easy to replace.
The thing is this as well. I would imagine that ships have a pretty long lifespan. And if you're looking at retrofitting, if you're looking at ships who can take alternative fuels, it means that there's some already quite significant costs sunk into ships which have been based upon bunker fuels, which are dirtier. And trying to repurpose them going forward is not going to be very easy. It'll take a lot of time, isn't it?
It depends why you're switching fuel. So we've got to go back to the philosophy of decarbonization, right? If we believe it's an existential threat and it needs to be done, then is there a price on our existence? Having said that, people aren't doing retrofits, especially in newer ships, because they have a longer time to amortize the retrofit costs.
Yeah.
And also, retrofitting has a lower carbon footprint than building a new vessel. So some studies have shown there's 2 million tons of CO2 through retrofit versus 70 million tons of CO2. And the retrofit time takes shorter, which means your impact on decarbonization is far greater.
But is there a business case for us to make two shippers out there that it is in their financial interest, is their commercial interest to do it and do it sooner? Or is it entirely just having to convince them from the sustainability perspective?
So I think the first stage is about convincing yourself there is a sustainability philosophy to be addressed. But what's also increasing in the marketplace, and people are beginning to see this, is consumers are asking for products that have come along the green supply chain, which means now there's pressure on the logistics side to be greener and therefore to be relevant in the future. And it looks like nearer future than later, that if your ship wants to be used to move goods, it better have a very low or zero carbon footprint.
That's an interesting point, because again, it goes back to consumers having that kind of information in knowing the entire sort of carbon footprint of whatever it is that they buy, right? For example, I get a car from Hyundai in Korea. I need to know, even if it's a green vehicle, even if it's an EV, I got to know how it got from the warehouse in Korea to Singapore, right? Isn't that the case?
Yes, that would be the ideal. It's trying to get as many consumers to drive the green agenda, which ultimately is where it sits, right? If consumers are not going to be bothered about the green agenda, then there's no incentives for people who are satisfying consumer needs to do the same.
Let me now talk about the alternatives that actually exist out there and people are looking at, whether they are viable now or maybe in the near future. What are they and are they really so viable? And are you optimistic?
I'll answer the last question first. I have to be optimistic, because if we don't find a solution, then it is going to be an existential issue. Are there fuels that have been considered? Yes. There's liquid ammonia, there's methanol or biomethanol. People are also looking at bio-LNG, looking at sustainable biofuels. And in the far-flung future is liquid hydrogen. And all these fuels need to have the right color. And the right color, I mean, they have to be green. People are talking about blue. There could be a transition, but we need to be careful about the blue versions of the molecule. So if you're going to be green, and it's quite far out, we need to understand how to handle it. So the first thing that we need to do is how to handle these fuels. And then hopefully people will make enough of it to supply the demand.
Talk a little bit about what Singapore is doing, right? Singapore and the MPA, how it's positioning itself and our overall approach towards the shipping industry and the approach that it's taking in sort of driving as far as possible the international agenda, but obviously it has to start with itself and ourselves. And we have a huge port being built at this time. Where are the innovations going to come as far as fuels and sustainability going to come from?
When it comes to innovation, everyone is looking at it from all quarters. I don't think Singapore is any different. And, you know, in some cases, may not have the resources to look at it. Well, what we need to understand is our role in that whole perspective. So I think for Singapore to maintain its bunkering status, must be prepared to be a multi-fuel bunkering hub, because I don't think the future will have one single fuel for every vessel that we have like today. And we're going to have to be prepared to do multiple fuels. So it's choosing which fuel to do and having the infrastructure to actually execute that and getting the ecosystem prepared to deliver that fuel to the vessels that come to Singapore to get refueled.
But would you not say then that obviously Singapore, as we've heard so often, is such a hub economy, a shipping hub as well. Isn't it therefore separate from the climate existentialism, economic existentialism? Isn't it therefore in our interest to be at the forefront of pushing the entire industry and positioning the Singapore maritime sector as the front runner in all these alternative fuels?
We can push, but we've got to push in the areas where we have strength to push. So, for example, we don't have hinterland to manufacture biofuels. Mm-hmm. We may have the Neste refinery that makes sustainable fuels. It's a question of capacity to meet demand. We don't have long tracts of empty land to put solar system to make green hydrogen. We don't have wind to generate green hydrogen either. So we've got to know what we have and what we don't have and push along the grains of our strength, which is really around leveraging our status as an international maritime center, corralling and collaborating across the 5,000 maritime related companies based in Singapore to have a collective philosophy and collective effort to make that change. So it's just not about changing, it's getting the philosophy of change ingrained at the leadership level. And then we can work together to find a solution that works for everyone. It is taking a leadership position, but leadership in the areas of strength and not trying to pretend we're strong in areas where we're weak.
One of these areas, I suppose, and you mentioned, is we have so many shipping companies here in Singapore. Is it in their interest to be here? Do they get a sense, you think, that this is where the action is at in terms of being at the forefront of shipping technology?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of effort going on in the background. There's a maritime-related innovation that is spearheaded by the Singapore Maritime Institute through the various research centers, IHLs, and polytechnics in Singapore. And then now where I am at the Global Center for Maritime Decarbonization, which was just set up on the 1st of August, mm-hmm. and funded by like-minded and organizations from the maritime sector together with the government to really push the agenda on decarbonization.
If I could just look at it again from the company's perspective, you know, you have big shipping companies like Maersk. They've set new and ambitious targets, having net zero CO2 emissions by 2050. Obviously, they're a huge company. They have the money, they have the technology to do things like that. Firstly, explain how they are able to do this. And are there things that smaller companies perhaps can leverage off, or will smaller companies always have to work off government-led, international organization-led efforts?
I think in the Maersk scenario, it's important for companies like Maersk to send those signals of change, because often and not, the supplier doesn't know where the demand is. So when you have demand centers like Maersk saying, I want to use fuel A, B, or C, It sends a signal to the business community that if I can find the ability to provide that supply, I have a willing buyer already. It is an important signal from Maersk, and Maersk can do it because of their size. And once that happens, people on the periphery who are within the Maersk routing, and they know, they say, oh, if Maersk is going to be able to bunker biofuels or ammonia in Singapore, then there's a high chance that supply chain would happen, and then therefore I can leverage off that. It's always trying to decide when I should build for what capacity. Having demand side proclamations from Maersk is very critical, and then we hope to see more so people on the supply side can get a sense of the economics of supply.
Looking at it, as far as companies go as well, they will look at what's happening internationally, right? Whether it's at the level of IMO and how fast they're pushing. And then again, there are individual jurisdictions like ours here in Singapore. And then you have the EU as well, which a couple of months ago proposed sort of relooking its ETS, the emissions trading system, and putting a price on shipping emissions. Do you think these efforts are needed? And if I were an owner of a shipping company and you see sort of jurisdictions like the EU quite often taking the front foot and pushing initiatives, and then you see the IMO maybe because it's much larger and everyone has to be bought in at a slightly different pace. How do you make sense of all this, especially when you do have something like the EU? How realistic is this, and will shipping companies actually at the end of the day say, you know, this is a bit too much?
No, I don't think so. I think generally most shipping companies want to be part of the solution. I don't think you'll find a shipping company out there, be rare. My guess is who says, Now, I think this whole climate change is a hoax and I'm just going to do whatever I want to do. There's general consensus among the maritime sector that something needs to be done. The question is how to do it.
Yeah.
And I think all these instruments are going to be needed because they nudge people to make the right decisions when you get bombarded from different angles of the solution space, and it'll nudge you across the line to get something done. The other thing is the presumption that it is the maritime sector that needs to absorb all the costs of change needs also to change. Everyone along the supply chain of goods and services needs to take some fair share of that burden of cost of change, because it's for our own good. Whether you're a producer, you're a shipper, or you're a user, right? So there must be some kind of sharing of responsibility that if it's going to cost 10% more to buy something that is shipped on a green ship, I should encourage that and buy it. Because the more I do it, the more economies of scale will bring that 10% down. But until we start thinking collectively and not try to blame one sector for all our ills, then we'll never get past fighting this climate change issue.
As we start to wrap up, I wanted to turn back around and talk to you a little bit about your new role. Singapore and shipping both are so intertwined, and as we've said several times, such a major shipping and a commercial hub. Within your new role now, paint for us the picture of how you see a Singapore in, let's say, 20, 30, 40 years' time. Still being a shipping hub, but obviously with a port that looks very different, with technology that looks very different, that contributes to the global effort in decarbonization. What would a hub like that look like? What would a port like that look like? And what do you hope to be able to do from your new perch?
My sense in the future is Singapore will be a hub able to provide decarbonized fuels in a very safe and secure manner to make sure that we can sustainably decarbonize the shipping industries. We're going to have the ability to do that professionally and safely to all the users in the future. For us to achieve that, we need to understand what we are dealing with. And this is where the Decarb Center comes in. What we want to fund is projects that allows us to pilot and demonstrate decarb technologies or alternative fuels in a safe manner, that it can be scaled and deployed across the world effectively. We are trying to be the facilitator of that by funding these projects, or ideating the project and then funding it with our stakeholder partners. But the future is going to be greener. The question is it going to be 100% green in the future? I can't tell you, but it's definitely going to be greener than today.
As always, Sanjay Kutin, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Jamie. Thank you for the opportunity.
And thanks for listening to The Climate Conversations. We will be taking a short break and we'll be back in October. Stay up to date on CNA's coverage of climate change on CNA.Asia. You can also find this and other CNA podcasts on our website, on iTunes and Spotify. The team behind this podcast are Crispina Robert, Lin Zuling, and Erin Low. I'm Jamie Ho. Till next week.